So I'd like to welcome you all to our teleseminar today, which is on coaching to improve employee performance. And Bill Osborne is the featured presenter today, and I'm going to modify a bit for him. Moderate, I'm sorry. Hey, Bill.
What have I done, Carol?
Maybe I'll modify, too. I don't know. I'll moderate a bit for him, maybe ask a few questions, but I invite everyone to be involved in asking questions, challenging anything that we come up with that doesn't sound right, or you know, really inquiring how this fits for you. So we'd like to get started here. You all have a handout so you can follow along the basic format that we're going through. And if anyone listens to this call later, because we do post the recorded call on my website, and you want the handout, all you have to do is send me an email. So Bill owns the people business, and that's a consulting and training and coaching firm here in Annapolis, and he provides some great services to companies and government organizations here. And Bill has a lot of experience in the human resources field. Bill, what is it, 20-some years in that field?
Yes, thank you. I just had a birthday. Yeah, it's been more than 20 years in the field. I spent 10 years as a human resources director, and my other hat in that job was training, and before and after that it's been training and development and coaching. So About 2 years ago, I struck out on my own and was lucky enough to meet Carol Kerr, who also is a refugee from the corporation.
Hey, we go from being hostages to being refugees.
Yes, and has her own business, which is Future Focus, and does an excellent job of training and development. And actually, I use Carol's large inventory of information and her wonderful insight more often than I'd like to admit. But I want to just publicly recognize you for that, Carol.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. You're welcome, Bill.
Oh.
Bill and I really do support each other in a lot of ways. We're independent. We run our own businesses, and we both do training through the Community College of Baltimore County as well through in their workforce development area. So our practices overlap, and we're great support to each other. So anyway, I'm looking forward to hearing Bill's presentation today, because as he benefits from what I've developed, I benefit from what he's developed. So with that, Bill, I'm going to let you get started.
Well, thank you very much. And folks, one housekeeping point and one just note point. If you're on speakerphone, it may be difficult to hear me. The volume usually goes down. So if you can come off speaker, if you have any problems with my volume, I'll shout into the microphone as much as I can. Secondly, I'm going to be discussing, not all of the things I'm going to discuss are on the PowerPoint slides that you have. So please don't go jumping around. I'll get to the slide you have directly, but I wanted to give myself some wiggle room. So here we go. We'll be talking about coaching and mentoring. And one of my favorite quotes, and as you may know, I love quotes. It's by Robert Louis Stevenson, and he said that don't judge each day by the harvest you reap, but by the seeds you plant. And I think that one of the best things that we can do in our management roles is to be coaches and either mentors or help folks to find mentors. What we'll be discussing today is just coaching, the difference between coaching and mentoring, and some the classic roles of coaches and how to be a great coach. We'll also talk about something new, and I like to call it the coaching tango, and it's a combination of some of the new neuroscience information about how we think combined with some of my coaching counseling experience. So I'm really excited to hear what you think about the coaching tango. And then finally, we'll speak a little bit about mentoring, the do's and don'ts, and hopefully some best practices. So some of the underlying assumptions when I put this program together was that we're struggling to retain. I have hire and retain, but hire the correct folks and retain skilled employees. And it's often difficult to predict the candidate's performance. We really want people to function at the highest levels, and sometimes they can't do that alone. That's how our coaching and mentoring can help out. The data that I've looked at says that coaching and or mentoring programs, either separately or combined, they have impressive results supporting the individuals as well as companies. And also, they really help to build teamwork within organizations. Hello. Want to pause and say hi? Who just came on?
Helen Diker.
Hi.
Hi.
Bill Osborne and Carol Kerr.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Carol. I'm glad I got in.
Hi, Helen. Yeah, Helen just sent me a quick email saying she couldn't get in. I sent her some info she got on now. So.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we use coach. We're in the full cry of the coaching and mentoring discussion. We use coaching and mentoring either as a follow-up training or to fine-tune job skills. Sometimes we need to model a mentor can model some of the correct skills and behavior. We can also help people prepare for future roles, and additionally, we can help mediate issues that folks may as coaches. So, but there are actually two sides of the same coin, and both rely heavily on Ben Franklin's comment that tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn. So some of the roles include, are most of you managers of some sort or another?
Yes.
Good. Well, managers, as you know, they manage things, they set goals, they make sure things happen, they do all that organizing and planning and implementing and evaluating. And they also have these two-legged things walking around that take leadership skills, which I think is a different set. However, again, that's the traditional manager role. Trainers actually add skills and helps keep folks on track. Coaching is a little bit different, and that's providing objective input and helping people to see options. So that's a different hat that you may wear from time to time. And, of course, the mentor models correct behavior. So just wanted to get those four roles that you play perhaps separated out a little bit. Today we'll be talking about the coaching and mentoring role. So when we think about being a great coach, we need to be individually, personally committed to investigating and nurturing our human capital. And some folks don't like that term, but I really do. Our human resources, our human capital. And when we're talking about coaching, it's this form of follow-up training, which you work with individuals either one-on-one, generally to build proficiency. And your aim is twofold. You want to maintain or enhance performance, or you may want to improve or redirect performance that needs some adjustments. Often it's the latter. Some of the qualities of a great coach is communication is key. You've got to be a great communicator, and that's true in any of the roles that we enumerated earlier, either manager, trainer, coach, mentor. Insightful, being able to see into an individual's, and generally we do that by watching behavior. Need to be committed to others, and that means we have to leave our own agenda behind, and sometimes that's the most difficult thing to do, at least for me. We need integrity so that we can be trustworthy and trusted. Need to be confident. And lastly, we need to be coachable. We need to be lifelong learners. I've never met a good coach who wasn't a lifetime learner and able to learn from critique. I'm going to pause for a second. Do we have another person join us?
Is that Carla Stewart who joined us?
Yes.
Hey, Carla. Sorry for my typo. Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
Hi. So a traditional coach's role is one where you support and direct from the sidelines. You don't necessarily get actively involved. If you've ever been worked on a team of any sort or been a member of a team, you'll know in athletics that there's the coach who pretty much can stand back and look at the big picture and perhaps add some guidance, particularly through constructive feedback. Two of the tools that are most effective in coaching is open and closed-ended questions. Inexperienced coaches and untrained coaches often will give their own opinion and they'll make a lot of declarative statements. They use the personal pronoun I and me frequently, when really what we need to do is be able to ask who, what, when, where, why advisedly and how. And then closed-ended questions like is it, does it, that sort of thing. So those are really our key tools, that and insight. We want to troubleshoot and discuss causes of observed problems and help the person we're coaching to plan actions for improvement. So the overall coaching process, again, this is the part where we're just talking about a traditional coaching process. Like any interaction, we want to put the employee at ease, find out what they already know, and we ask the open-ended questions for that. We want to present information or demonstrate methods. We might repeat the process, try to evaluate their learning, and often I ask, and Carol does as well, what are the three things that you're going to take away from this session, if you will, or this meeting? That you're going to do differently, or you're going to work on.
So, Bill, I wonder if you could give me an example of an open-ended question you might ask someone when you're first sitting down with them to get kind of a handle on where they need to go.
Well, I might ask them some goal questions. I might say, this is after the pleasantries are out of the way. I might ask, well, what are the three biggest goals that you have or the brightest, shiniest goals that you have for our discussion? If they say I was forced to be here by some sort of personnel action, generally I'll say, okay, but my next question is, have you thought about getting past the feeling of being a hostage and how could we make this productive and valuable?
Okay, that sounds good. I remember one fellow that I encountered was assigned a coach, and I talked to him a little bit about that. I said, that must have been pretty uncomfortable, and he agreed, and we got kind of past that thing. And he said to me, but, you know, if I'm going to spend an hour a week with you, I'm going to get something out of this. And I thought, you know, that's really good. So then I asked him, well, what's your biggest challenge? And he said to me, well, my employees don't like me. And so what would you say to someone who asked you that question, who said that to you?
Well, I think I'd start asking them. I'd first of all say, how does that make you feel? And I don't mean that in the Dr. Phil sense. But I'm trying to get a feeling of the impact. And I might ask, what's the impact of that on you and your ability to manage?
Oh, that's a great way to ask it. Rather than bring up that feeling word that sends some of the men through the, you know.
We're going to do male bashing?
No.
Sorry
about that. I am sorry about that. So some of the people who are just, you know, wired in a way that they don't want to speak of their feelings.
Exactly. The how do you feel question, I always try to avoid that as much as possible. And then I'd ask, how do you know? that they don't like you. I look for some behavioral cues because I'm not sure whether that's an assumption on that person's part or not. And it also helps to get them in touch with the reality of the situation, have them go back, paint some pictures, perhaps give me a Polaroid, describe something as though it was a Polaroid picture on an event which he interpreted as the employee, an example of employees don't.
Oh, I like that. I like the Polaroid picture idea.
Yeah, it's really, it's tough to do, but it's a great discipline when you're in coaching because once you get folks to get in touch with their memory, it's easier to get them to in touch with their thinking. And in a little bit, we're going to chat about their thinking when I talk about the tango.
But, okay.
That's my prejudice. So, the last thing that I on the coaching overall coaching process is the rewards. It would be really, really great if we get some sort of reward, even if it's just recognition at the end of every coaching meeting. I like to recognize folks for when they've made an accomplishment in terms of insight that they've tried hard. Some mm-hmm. of my coaching sessions, I think people end up with a little perspiration on their forehead because it's really difficult to get past the day-to-day and get involved in not only what their perceptions are, but finding options. Y'all are welcome to ask me any questions you like. Thank you. Everybody on mute? Cricket? Okay. Well, we'll move on. Introducing the coaching tango, and the tango is described as a syncopated ballroom dance, danced by couple. And they have many varied steps, figures, and poses. And as you know, it takes two to tango. The reason I call this form of coaching a tango, because it really is between you and the person that you're coaching. And the coach's job is to follow that lead and even perhaps sometimes lead it a little bit, give a little bit of guidance. But it's the two of you involved in speaking out solutions, finding options, and helping folks plan strategies and steps that will take them to their goals. It's not an observation viewpoint like some of the more traditional coaching, not sitting back. You're actually part of the issue. So, because coaching is most often focused on things that people do consistently, we need to get in touch with their awareness because often folks aren't aware that they're doing things. For example, poor interpersonal skills. I think very few folks are aware if their skills are not productive, aren't useful in terms of interpersonal relations. Not following policies and procedures. As an HR director, we had about 500 folks, and the owner of the company used to tell me that he thought that there was about 498 people came in every day wanting to do a good job, and that our job was to help them do that, that very few people really wanted to mess up. So not following policies and procedures may indeed be the behavior, but we're not sure they're aware of it, and also not listening. So basically, I'm describing folks who are in a rut, and I hate to say this, but most of us are in terms of how we conduct our lives, in terms of not having insight into the thinking that drives our emotions and drives our behavior. The other concept that I'd like you to think about is that when our thinking is hardwired, by that I mean we lock our thoughts in, and these affect our behavior, and they often are unconscious. So hardwiring, have you ever tried to change someone's behavior? Yes, no?
Yes.
Yeah. How successful have you been? I haven't been very successful at all. Until recently, when I started the coaching training I went through helped me to develop this coaching tango. Tango, rather, And that is often it was really it's really tough to change people's opinion or their behavior or their thoughts about things because they're so locked in. And now there's some scientific evidence as to why we do that. Do you have the PowerPoint slide with the iceberg?
I don't.
No, there's no picture on it.
Dang, the picture didn't make it. Okay, well, there's this picture it in your mind, an iceberg, and the majority of the iceberg is underwater, and the water is translucent so that you can actually see the iceberg, but just a little tip of it is above. And that's really the behavior and how productive we are. That's what we see, which is above the surface. And what's below the surface in an individual are emotions that often drive the behavior, and the thinking way, way down emerged, which actually drives the emotion. Kurt Lewin said that attitude affects behavior, which affects productivity. And in the last century, that was another way of explaining what that iceberg model would be. I'll see if I can't resend that or perhaps make it available on the website.
You know, one of the things that I recall from my Franklin Covey training is the Covey model that teaches you that you really have to change the beliefs and the values that a person assigns to things if you're going to change behavior, because that's what drives behavior.
You bet.
Now, he illustrates it kind of as a circle. The values flow into beliefs, or vice versa. Our beliefs drive our values, and the values drive behaviors. And it's a circular pattern. And if you think of interrupting that circle at any point, what we usually do is we attack it at the level of the behavior. We see the behavior and we respond to that. But if we don't help people to go underneath and understand what drove that behavior, we'll never get lasting results.
Well said.
Sometimes you can, through a mandate, get a person to change the behavior and then reinforce for them how well that's working. If you're getting better results because you force them to change a behavior, sometimes you can do that and get them then to change the thinking about the behavior or the beliefs and values that drive it, and it will become sustained. But it will not be sustained long term until you get to that belief level.
Okay. And there's actually scientific proof that this line of discovery is absolutely correct. John Rady at Harvard is a research physician and psychiatrist, and what he's done is he studied along with his lab friends, the interaction of our brain cells, our neurons, and the dendrites, which are the little hanging down things that look like jellyfish that actually hook up with other dendrites from other neurons. And this is the thought process. And when chemicals pass back and forth, of course, they call that a synapse. They're actually able to observe this. What they found is after those chemicals move back and forth a couple times, after that thought is reinforced, it's very difficult to separate. So in that case, he's saying that our thinking really is hardwired and it's very, very powerful. So that may be the reason why traditional methods aren't as successful in getting people to realize, have insights in their behavior and change them. The good news is that there are 100 billion neurons, give or take one or two, in our brain. And each neuron has about 10,000 dendrites hanging down, ability to make a connection. And what that amounts to is about 40 quadrillion possible thoughts we could have in a lifetime. Now, 40 quadrillion is some sort of astrophysics distance between in miles here in another galaxy. It's a huge number. So although it's difficult to change established connections, it's easy to create new thinking. Once we create new thinking, that can be reinforced to the point where it is hardwired. So the whole thought about coaching right now is to get folks to take a look at thinking that is hardwired, the assumptions that are made that causes folks to act, and then help them find options. And I refer to this as butt problems. I spell that with one T, advisedly. When you're talking to someone, they say, yeah, I'd really like to do that, but, and then they tell you all the reasons they can't. That's an indication of hardwired thinking and a lack of the ability to find options. Once we help them see that, be aware of it, and then we can help them find options, and then they can hardwire the new options, and away we go. So that's pretty much the process.
So, I really like what you said there, Bill, because, you know, one of the things I find myself telling people is to think of the and. You know, okay, this is the way it's been done. This is the way you like to do it. This is the way you're comfortable. And are there other things to try? And so what you're saying is if we can get to that point where we can move them to the end, if you start challenging people and saying, but the way you're doing it is wrong, you get resistance because of that hard wiring.
Yeah.
But if you can bridge it with an and get them to experience an alternative, and then that starts working better, that's that behavior thing that can build a new belief. Is that right?
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah, I don't really approach it in that way, but I think that works. Absolutely. And there are a lot of ways to get the where we want to be. But the concept is absolutely accurate. Yes.
One question, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
With learning new thought processes, have there been any studies on coaching generations, like the Y generation as opposed to the X generation?
Yeah, I found
that the Y generation is much more difficult than the older generations.
Yes, yeah.
And you would think just the opposite. You would think if they're older, they're more hardwired, but I haven't found that. I have found it's the younger generation.
Yeah, generation is really impacting, I think, a lot of our thinking. And by older, you're meaning the boomers and some X generation?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Y generation, well, let me ask you, what do you think it is about the characteristics of the Y generation that makes it a little bit difficult for them to change hardwired thinking?
I think I have a daughter that's a Y generation. But she has the characteristics of an X generation because she was raised by a single mom and, you know, things were just different for her than they were for most. But I think a lot of times they have a sense of entitlement. I've always said this generation coming up is a generation of narcissists.
It is. How old is she?
She's 23.
Okay. There's a split in the Y, as you know, and there's the millennials, the ones that graduated high school around 2000. Some of that group of Ys have really moved away from narcissism and actually more resemble boomers in terms of conservatism and team play. And they actually admire interacting with older people. They like to do it, which is weird. However, I think you're absolutely right that the Y generation, again, your daughter's a little more X, but the Y generation has been the most indulged generation so far. Perhaps the millennials will prove me wrong, but they've made a lot of decisions for themselves. For example, single parenting. Your daughter had to make while you were working had to make a number of decisions that she might could discuss with you anyway.
Correct.
Small stuff like what to watch on TV and things like
that. Right, and what to cook dinner or what to cook for dinner because mom wasn't going to be home till 7, and you know.
The hardwired thinking, it can get really wired in there. Yeah, that's a great observation. Again, neuroscience has found that the best way to change our perception is to create new thinking. And while we're on the topic of thinking, I'd like to talk to you just briefly, cover about 5 levels of thinking, and 3 of them are useful and 2 of them aren't. So when you're coaching someone, try to stay with questions and discussions about moving forward. In other words, what's your vision? What's your strategy about if there's an issue? How to change, how to resolve the issue. The next level that's useful is planning. If we have a strategy, how are we going to get there moving forward? And finally, the action steps that are needed. So if you think about it, let's set some goals. What are your goals? And help them to set a strategy to get there. The planning are the what we need to do to get there, and the action steps are literally the little milestones to help us get there. In your discussions, if you could stay on those topics, that will be excellent, because each one of those involves moving forward. The two that are extremely useless are problems, and that's the but problems. They don't see options, and they want to just go back and talk about the problem over and over again. And after you've heard it, you understand it, you might have asked them some clarifying questions about the problem. After that, it's really time to move on, because any more time spent on that is useless. And the real, really useless thing is drama. Any folks get involved, be exposed to drama in the workplace?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of emotional mud. I like to call it emotional mud. And it's very seductive to human beings because we really love to hear about it. Oh, really? What's been going on? They did what? Having said that, it doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't help us solve any problems. It doesn't create new thinking. So what we want to do is we want to stay in... And the two words that I use frequently when I find someone involved in problems and drama, and again, after I figured out what they clarified for me and I understand what the problem is, I'll use these two words. Moving forward, what do you suppose to do? And keep them moving in a positive direction. And staying out of problems and avoiding the drama mud is a good thing. So... getting back to the tango, that's the science behind it. So the easiest way to help people to change their thoughts and beliefs and attitudes to move them out of the rut is to add new ones, help them create new ones. But they first need to be aware of that hard wiring. I have some questions, and this is taken from my notes from a client who for obvious reasons has to remain nameless. However, this person was accused of, it was a manager who was accused of creating a hostile work environment by his employees. Okay. So the steps in the process, the first thing to do was to ask for permission to discuss a skill issue. So I said, may I ask you a few questions regarding how you think about your employees? And the person did and said, well, you know, I really don't think about them much at all until recently when all this trouble happened. And I don't think they appreciate all I do for them. What do you think we're hearing there, folks? Hardwired thinking. And also the fact that it was very unconscious until it was brought to his attention. And I asked questions regarding how they think about the skill issue. So it might be, what do you think about when they ask you questions or tell you about what happened in a certain situation? And... the person I was coaching said, I'm trying not to use his name, person I was coaching said, well, you know, I really just try to focus on the problem. I'm a problem solver. I'm a here and now kind of person, and I don't really think much about it at all. I just, you know, when they ask me a question, I answer them, and when they tell me something happened, I inquire them to make sure that nothing went wrong and that everything's okay, and then I move on. So you see, what I'm hearing here is a pattern of a person that just is not really in tune with folks and may come across as someone who is at least hostile and uncaring and perhaps may be offending. So I continue to ask the person to describe what they think about the issue. Well, how often do you think about what your folks have to say? Or how important are they to how well you do your job? What I'm trying to do is get in touch and actually get the person in touch with their hardwired thinking. And these questions are hard, and this guy did, but in general they will say, "I don't know." And the answer, you might want to write this down. The next question is, well, if you did know, what do you think it would be? And almost every one of my questions asks them about their thinking, because subliminally I want them to get in touch with that. So how often do you think about what they had to say? Well, I don't know. Well, okay. But if you did know, if you did think about it, how often do you think it would be? Geez, I don't know. Well, if a third person was in the room and had been spent the day with you, how often do you think your behavior would indicate that you're thinking about what they say? At any rate, I try to get through the resistance there, but what we're doing is getting them in touch. What will happen if you're just really persistent with your questions and you don't allow folks to say things like "I don't know" without being really reflective? You might get to some sort of insight. In other words, they're actually uncovering how they think and feel about the situation. And I like to paraphrase. So it sounds like you think that you've not been focused on them or their reaction. Is that right? And long silence. Well, yeah. Good. Always give reinforcements. So what other reactions might they have? In other words, what other way could you elicit another reaction from them? Now I'm looking for options. Do your folks react differently to other managers? Well, what do you think would cause them to react differently? What I got from them was that there was actually a woman manager in a support department who they really liked, and they were acquaintances. They got along, he and she. And I said, well, why don't you ask this other manager what she thinks about folks and how she approaches them, what her thinking is in that regard. That's one of his homework assignments. And he came back and was talking to me about how this other manager was really careful about how she spoke to folks. Really careful about volume and nonverbal signs and reflective statements. So we pursued some thoughts. Well, what do you think that they might react positively if you spoke to them in a different way? And how are different ways that you could do that? And now we're starting to put in new habits, new thought process. We want to hardwire these things in.
Bill?
Yes.
I'm just going to give you a five-minute warning, okay?
Well, thank you very much. It looks like it's close to quarter of, or will be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just have to finish this and go real quickly through mentoring, if that's okay. So, finally, setting the action steps with due dates. So, paraphrasing, it says, okay, so you've agreed to write down four ways to change your communications to your employees. And once you do, we'll go over it tomorrow morning. Then you can practice, we'll practice your new communications with both here, and if you practice it here, why don't you practice it with that other manager that you've been talking to, and also practice it at home. And what I'm doing there is getting him to create some hardwired thinking, or thinking about it over and over again, practicing. You use these new techniques at least six times per day, and then next Monday, you and I will get together and we'll go over the results. So after that, and neuroscience has also found that people learn better by building on positive instead of reinforcing negatives. They're actually able to watch connections being made, and they found that, oddly enough, that the positive reinforcement works really, is much more powerful. So sounds like you got a great plan going here. You've identified what may be bothering your employees, and you have a plan to change things. Just keep in mind that we all have had similar concerns. And the answer is to make an effort to think about how you sound to others. If you do this often, it'll become second nature. So that's just a real quick paraphrase of the process. Any questions at this point? Okay. Then look quickly at mentoring, and then I'll have to close. Mentoring, I like Mother Teresa who comment or quote who said that to keep a lamp burning, we have to put some oil in it occasionally. That's a great idea. And that's really what mentoring is. So, clearly, mentoring is getting either a senior employee or a manager, particularly if it's going to be someone who's being groomed into a leadership role, to work with the person unofficially to help the other person learn the ropes, to see where the hidden pitfalls are, if there are any, and to give them feedback and to be a role model. So the clear thing you want to do is you really want to pick the right person to be a mentor. Generally, we look at their goals, and if they really enjoy working with people, then that's the person you're looking for. And again, I look over the PowerPoints on this. I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. Keep in mind, and I this is through my own missteps, not all senior or top employees are good mentors. I put a couple of people together and found out that the top employee was showing the new employee how to get around things, how to literally subvert some of the systems so that you can get what you want. So great mentors get satisfaction from helping others. And remember, both parties have to be voluntary in this. Mentor functions, they're teachers, they're counselors, they're go-betweens, they act as advocates. Some really critical behaviors, of course, are all the communication skills, listening, encouraging two-way communications, being able to provide insight, and somewhat intimacy, in other words, into me see, identifying opportunities. It's important to train mentors, not just sort of go do it. Train them in advertising and empowering people, advising rather, and empowering people, and criticizing constructively, and teach them how to avoid rescuing. Sometimes people need to make minor mistakes in order to learn. I guess the most advice that I can provide regarding the mentor relationship is to have a specific goal or goals for the mentor relationship. Pick the right folks and make sure they're good fits. But what this can do is it can be a force multiplier for managers. Often managers have their own things and they're really busy doing their own projects and their own jobs, and they may not have time to work with new folks or work with folks that they would really like to groom. And that's where other employees who otherwise fit the bill can be really valuable. And Carol, I'd really like to hear some questions if the folks have any.
Okay. Hey, Bill, I really liked your emphasis here on creating new thoughts. For me, there were some insights. You know, I'm a coach. I coach people on a regular basis, and I think there are some real applications that I can draw from this. I wonder if anyone else would like to either question that or comment on ways they see applying that.
Well,
does anybody have an example you'd like to share with a group of perhaps a behavior you'd like to address that Bill could make some suggestions on?
Well, again, we looked at about 6 months of study in about 45 minutes, and I'll be happy to if you have a question, please shoot me an email. I'll be happy to discuss it with you further.
I'd like to say, I mean, I really enjoyed this. I liked the thinking about changing, you know, changing the beliefs to change behavior. But it's also big, you know. It's like, I mean, I know it's true, and I can't think of an example right now. But it's just like it's just. you know, it's almost like something that you really would have to see or hear some really good examples of somebody doing that.
Let me recommend a book to read, if I may.
Sure.
And it's called Quiet Leadership. Quiet Leadership. And the gentleman's name is David Rock, R-O-C-K.
Uh-huh.
And he is he was the person that I studied coaching under. And he's so the Quiet Leadership are 6 steps to transforming performance at work. And I think that will help you see the big picture and maybe see how it'll apply to you. And you're absolutely right. This is huge, and 45 minutes is tough to do. What my goal is to get you all thinking about it.
That was accomplished.
Okay.
Definitely.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, everybody. You know, everybody was able to stay with us all of this time, and I'm very pleased for that, Bill. That says people were very engaged too. And we do this once a month, whenever possible. So we'll let you know when we have another teleseminar coming up. Meanwhile, if you would like to listen to this again or download it, it will be available on my website. FutureFocusCoaching.com under the events and recordings page by tomorrow morning. And Bill, have you been posting the recordings to your website?
No, but I will. And that's my website is bill@peoplebusiness, one word, peoplebusiness.us. And be careful, a lot of people put .com in there, but I couldn't get that, so it's .us.
Thank you all for being here, and
we
look forward to your joining us in the future. We'll keep you informed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye now.